Chapter 8. Decentralized Command. Jocko Willink. South Central Ramadi, Iraq. A reckoning. "We've got armed enemy fighters on top of a building. Appear to be snipers," the radio blared. The concern and excitement in the American soldier's voice relaying the information was evident. This report was alarming and immediately struck a chord with everyone on the radio net. Enemy snipers were deadly. While they could never compare to the level of skill, training, and equipment that our own U.S. military snipers possessed, the enemy certainly had some skilled marksmen who inflicted substantial damage, regularly killing or wounding American and Iraqi soldiers with accurate rifle shots. Two different elements of our task unit Bruiser SEALs were out there in enemy territory among a hostile insurgent force with friendly U.S. Army troops moving into the area. My job was command and control of 30-plus SEALs and their partner force of Iraqi soldiers, but I could only manage this effectively through decentralized command. It was the only way to operate. On the battlefield, I expected my subordinate leaders to do just that: lead. I had groomed and trained them. Leif and his fellow SEAL officers, their platoon chiefs, and senior petty officers, to make decisions. I trusted that their assessment of the situations they were in and their decisions would be aggressive in pursuit of mission accomplishment, well thought out, tactically sound, and would ultimately further our strategic mission. They confirmed that trust over and over again throughout our months in Ramadi. Leif and my other leaders were put in some of the worst situations imaginable. Enemy fire, confusion and chaos, friendly fire, and worst of all, the pain and emotion of our brother SEALs wounded or killed. In each of those situations, they led with authority and courage, making rapid, sequential, life and death decisions in harrowing situations with limited information. I trusted them. They had earned that trust through many months of training, of getting it wrong and learning from their mistakes as I watched them closely and coached them in the leadership principles I had learned through 15 years in the SEAL teams. Both of my platoon commanders were relatively new to the teams, but luckily, they were both eager to learn, eager to lead, and most important, humble yet confident to command. But once we were in Ramadi, I could no longer be with them to look over their shoulders and guide them. I had to empower them to lead. After seeing them evolve during our training cycle into bold, confident leaders, I knew that Leif and Charlie Platoon and his fellow platoon commander in Delta Platoon would make the right decisions. And I knew they would ensure that their subordinate leaders within each of their platoons would make the right decisions. I unleashed them on the battlefield to execute with full confidence in their leadership. Pushing the decision-making down to the subordinate frontline leaders within the task unit was critical to our success. This decentralized command structure allowed me, as the commander, to maintain focus on the bigger picture, coordinate friendly assets, and monitor enemy activity. Were I to get embroiled in the details of a tactical problem, there would be no one else to fill my role and manage the strategic mission. The proper understanding and utilization of decentralized command takes time and effort to perfect. For any leader, placing full faith and trust in junior leaders with less experience and allowing them to manage their teams is a difficult thing to embrace. It requires tremendous trust and confidence in those frontline leaders, who must very clearly understand the strategic mission and ensure that their immediate tactical decisions ultimately contribute to accomplishing the overarching goals. Frontline leaders must also have trust and confidence in their senior leaders to know that they are empowered to make decisions and that their senior leaders will back them up. This skill of decentralized command had not been magically bestowed upon Task Unit Bruiser. It had come only through difficult preparation and training, driven home during the months of effort before we deployed to Iraq. We learned our greatest lessons in this during MOUNT, Military Operations Urban Terrain Training, at Fort Knox, Kentucky. There, Under intense pressure and extremely challenging scenarios, we learned how to employ this tenet effectively in the most chaotic scenarios. The Mount facility was a multi-block, mock city of concrete structures, ranging from simulated one-room houses to large, complex, multi-story buildings built to prepare units for the challenges of urban combat, exactly the environment in which U.S. forces were then heavily engaged in Iraq. The SEAL Training Detachment, or TRADET, which I would later command, was tasked with preparing SEAL platoons and task units for deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, and we knew they would put us through the ringer. The TRADET instructor cadre constructed training scenarios to confuse, disorient, physically and mentally stress, and overwhelm the participating SEAL units, particularly the leaders. The instructor cadre would mudsuck us at every turn, a SEAL term for a cheap shot or a sucker punch. Their role players, acting as enemy forces in training scenarios, often wouldn't follow the rules of play. Some SEALs scoffed at this, thinking the training was unrealistically challenging, and accused TRADET of cheating. I disagreed. The enemy we would face in Iraq had no rules. They didn't care about collateral damage. They didn't care about fratricide or friendly fire. Iraqi insurgents were experts at analyzing and exploiting our weaknesses. They were brutal savages, and their method of operation was to think of the most horrific, cowardly, and effective ways to kill us. So we actually needed TRADET to do the same thing to us. During the first few days of Task Unit Bruiser's mount training, my SEAL leaders tried to control everything and everyone themselves. They tried to direct every maneuver, control every position, and personally attempted to manage each one of their men, up to 35 individuals in Task Unit Bruiser. It did not work. In a striking realization that military units throughout history have come to understand by experience, it became clear that no person had the cognitive capacity, the physical presence, or the knowledge of everything happening across a complex battlefield to effectively lead in such a manner. Instead, my leaders learned that they must rely on their subordinate leaders to take charge of their smaller teams within the team and allow them to execute based on a good understanding of the broader mission, known as commander's intent, and standard operating procedures. That was effective decentralized command. So, we divided into small teams of 4 to 6 SEALs, a manageable size for a leader to control. Each platoon commander didn't worry about controlling all 16 SEAL operators assigned. Only 3, his squad leaders and his platoon chief. Each platoon chief and leading petty officer only had to control their fire team leaders, who each controlled 4 SEAL shooters. And I only had to control 2 people, my 2 platoon commanders. Each leader was trusted to lead and guide his team in support of the overall mission. Those junior leaders learned that they were expected to make decisions. They couldn't ask, "What do I do?" Instead, they had to state, "This is what I am going to do." Since I made sure everyone understood the overall intent of the mission, every leader worked and led separately, but in a unified way that contributed to the overall mission, making even the most chaotic scenarios much easier to handle. When Task Unit Bruiser deployed to Ramadi, Iraq, decentralized command played a crucial role in our success. We supported many large-scale operations and participated in virtually every big push into Ramadi as coalition forces established footholds in enemy territory. A few months into our deployment, we conducted our largest operation yet. It included 2 different U.S. Army battalions, each with hundreds of soldiers, a U.S. Marine battalion, nearly 100 armored vehicles on the ground, and American aircraft in the skies overhead. Many of these units operated on different communications networks, which greatly added to the complexity and compounded the risk. Our SEAL sniper teams would lead the way into the area of operations. By occupying the high ground with the best visibility over the battlefield, Task Unit Bruiser SEALs would gain substantial tactical advantage over the enemy and protect other U.S. forces on the ground. but all this movement could create chaos. My job was to provide command and control to coordinate between my SEAL sniper overwatch teams from Charlie and Delta Platoon and the U.S. Army and Marine Corps units. This operation centered around a major north-south road that was sandwiched between two notoriously violent neighborhoods, the Malab District, a war-torn neighborhood to the east, and to the west, J Block, an American designation for an equally violent section of central Ramadi. In the Malab, Task Unit Bruiser suffered our first casualty during the initial weeks of our deployment. A young SEAL operator sustained a gunshot wound from an enemy armor-piercing machine gun round, which shattered his femur and ripped a massive hole in his leg. SEAL machine gunner Mike Mansour laid down suppressive fire and helped drag him out of the street to safety. Luckily, the wounded SEAL survived and returned to the States for a long road to recovery. The SEALs in Corregidor were in firefights on an almost daily basis in the Malab. Leif and the SEALs of Charlie Platoon had been likewise heavily engaged in constant gun battles with enemy fighters. In the J Block, only a couple of weeks prior, Ryan Job was shot in the face by an enemy sniper and left blind. Later, on the same day Ryan was wounded, Mark Lee was shot and killed just down the street in the J Block from where Ryan had been wounded. Mark was the first member of Task Unit Bruiser killed in action, and the first Navy SEAL killed in Iraq. We were still reeling from those losses suffered during what was one of the most furious battles that had taken place in Ramadi. Leif had also been wounded, hit in the back with a round during the battle. Although injured, it had not stopped him from continuing to lead during that operation. Nor had it dulled his desire to hunt down the enemy and kill them. It was no coincidence that our largest operation would take place in this area. It was a reckoning. The operation began as our SEALs, under cover of darkness, patrolled on foot into position. Charlie Platoon from Cop Falcon to the west, and Delta Platoon from Cop Eagle's Nest to the east. They passed their positions over the radio periodically so that I, staged with our Army counterparts at Cop Falcon and other friendly forces, could track their movement. Both Charlie and Delta Platoons had pre-selected locations for their sniper overwatch positions based on careful map studies of the area. With the greater strategic picture to coordinate, I had left this entirely up to them. They also had full authority to shift locations if those pre-selected positions weren't adequate once they were on the ground. As they had been trained, the senior leader of each SEAL sniper overwatch element made their decisions based on the underlying commander's guidance that drove our overwatch operations. 1. Cover as many enemy ingress and egress routes as possible. 2. Set up positions that mutually support each other. 3. Pick solid fighting positions that could be defended against heavy enemy attack for an extended period of time if necessary. With their lives and the lives of their men at risk, my platoon commanders understood this guidance as well, perhaps even better than I. Therefore, I did not need to spell it out for each operation. It was embedded in their thoughts. With it, my frontline leaders were empowered to make the tactical decisions during the operation. They were the ones who were on the scene to make the call while I was located over a kilometer away at Cop Falcon, tracking the mission alongside U.S. Army commanders. Sometimes, despite detailed map studies and planning, my frontline leaders discovered that their pre-planned locations were not viable. On numerous occasions, our overwatch elements arrived at a building they had planned to utilize, only to realize that the building was set farther back from the road than it appeared on the map, or did not have optimal angles to cover enemy routes and protect friendly positions. Other times, the building was surrounded by dead space, areas that would be difficult to see and difficult to defend. Then it was up to the platoon leadership to select another building that could best accomplish the mission. Here, decentralized command was a necessity. In such situations, the leaders did not call and ask me what they should do. Instead, they told me what they were going to do. I trusted them to make adjustments and adapt the plan to unforeseen circumstances while staying within the parameters of the guidance I had given them and our standard operating procedures. I trusted them to lead. My ego took no offense to my subordinate leaders on the front lines calling the shots. In fact, I was proud to follow their lead and support them. With my leaders running their teams and handling the tactical decisions, it made my job much easier by enabling me to focus on the bigger picture. On this particular operation, Charlie Platoon's pre-planned position worked well. But Delta Platoon realized that they could not utilize the building that they had planned to use. Delta's platoon commander and his senior platoon leadership scouted out another building that could work. The commander radioed and told me his platoon would move across the street to the other building, Building 94. I responded to him over the radio. "This is Jocko. I copy. You want to move to Building 94. Do it." Delta Platoon then immediately pushed this information to the rest of the friendly forces, including the U.S. Army Battalion staff and company leadership with which I was co-located at Kalp Falcon. I sat back and watched as their plan was relayed and ensured the information was clear at higher headquarters. Once all friendly forces had been notified and Delta Platoon confirmed that, they initiated movement to the newly selected building. Building 94 proved to be a very good vantage point. One of the tallest buildings in the area, at 4 stories in height, it had a clear view of the major north-south road and of the location where the Army would soon construct Cop Grant, the new combat outpost. Building 94 was easily defensible and offered good firing positions that covered many potential enemy routes in and out of the area. Once Delta Platoon was in position, their radio man reported, "Building 94 secure. Overwatch position set in the 4th story. And on rooftop." "Copy," I acknowledged. The radio men then relayed that information to other units in the area, and I confirmed that the other units understood the location of Delta's new position. With Charlie and Delta platoons now secured in their positions, American troops flooded into the area. This stage of the mission left U.S. forces highly vulnerable. With no permanent security yet in place, brave Army engineers began building the COP, a construction project in a hostile combat zone. Tensions rose in the streets and among the command and control element I was with back at Kalp Falcon. As friendly forces moved in, reports of possible enemy movement came in over the radio nets. Lights came on in buildings, while in others, lights went out. Vehicles started up, departed driveways, and moved through the streets. A military-aged male maneuvered through the alleyways, observing friendly troop movements. A report described a possible enemy force of 2 to 4 military-aged males exiting a building and dispersing. Other men were seen talking on radios. This was the most nerve-wracking time, before the shooting started, waiting with anxious anticipation for a fight to happen. Our SEALs and the hundreds of U.S. troops in this operation had fought fierce battles with the enemy in the bordering neighborhoods for the past several months. Much American blood had been spilled, including the blood of our SEAL brothers. Now, it was only a matter of time before the enemy attacked, which we expected would be ferocious. Then, from a Bradley fighting vehicle equipped with thermal sight for nighttime operations, the report came over the radio. "We've got armed enemy fighters on top of a building. Appear to be snipers." A single enemy bullet had struck Ryan Job, severely wounding him, leaving him blind, and eventually leading to his death. A young Marine from 2nd Anglico, whom we frequently worked with, had been shot and killed by a single rifle shot just a few weeks before. Many others had been wounded or killed by a single round. Just as our snipers struck fear into the hearts of our enemy, an enemy sniper was a nightmare scenario for us. Shooting accurately from unseen positions, inflicting casualties, and fading away. So now this report comes across the net that enemy snipers had been spotted caused everyone's defenses to spike and escalated the tensions in their trigger fingers. Charlie and Delta platoons, in their separate overwatch positions, heard the report on their radios and were also amped up by the call. Perhaps one or more of these enemy snipers were the culprits responsible for shooting Ryan and our Marine comrade. Any one of our SEALs would gladly eliminate the enemy snipers with lethal force. But despite the romantic vision of a sniper versus sniper stalking and shooting match, our preferred contest was a much more lopsided affair. Enemy sniper versus the massive firepower of a US M1 A2 Abrams main battle tank. An enemy sniper might barricade himself in a room behind sandbags and concrete. While this made for a difficult rifle shot, it was no match for the tank's electronically enhanced optics and giant 120mm smoothbore cannon fired from behind the safety of heavy armor. We all hoped for a quick engagement by the Bradley that had spotted the enemy sniper. Of course, I wanted as much as anyone to see an enemy sniper, or even better, multiple snipers eliminated. But this was a complex battlefield, which could confuse and confound even the most experienced soldiers and SEALs. The fog of war in a chaotic urban environment grows thick rapidly and could muddle even the most seemingly obvious situations. The company commander, a U.S. Army captain in charge of the Bradley fighting vehicle that reported the enemy snipers, was an exceptional warrior and leader whom our SEALs had come to deeply respect and admire. He and his soldiers were an outstanding group. We had formed a tremendous bond with them through dozens of operations working together. Our SEAL snipers supported their operations, and they in turn responded continuously to our calls for help by rolling out in their tanks down extremely dangerous, uncleared roads to bring firepower to bear and provide evacuation of our SEAL casualties. Every time we called for help, the company commander fearlessly placed himself and his men at great risk. He personally saddled up and drove out in his tank to bring the thunder on our behalf and beat back enemy attacks on SEAL positions. Now, the company commander heard the report of enemy snipers. He responded over the radio, "Give a description of the target." The Bradley's vehicle commander answered, "Several military-aged males on a rooftop. They appear to have some heavy weapons, and some have what appear to be sniper weapons with scopes." Monitoring the radio calls, I stood next to the company commander in the makeshift talk inside Cop Falcon. Knowing I had SEAL snipers on the rooftop near where the enemy was spotted, I quickly asked, "Find out what building number they see the enemy in." The company commander radioed his Bradley commander for an exact position. "Building 7-9. Replied the Bradley vehicle commander. "Your guys aren't in Building 7-9, are they?" the company commander asked me, just to be sure. I looked at my battle map to coordinate the numbers I was hearing over the net. I located Building 7-9, just down the street from where Delta Platoon was located, in Building 9-4. "Negative," I replied to the captain. "I've got SEALs in Building 9-4, not in 7-9. "All right, let's engage," said the captain, fired up to take out some enemy snipers. Every one of us was eager to hammer enemy fighters and protect the U.S. troops on the ground in harm's way. But we had to be sure. "Stand by," I said. "Let's confirm what we have here." I keyed up my radio to talk to my SEALs on the less formal net that only we utilized. I spoke directly to Delta's platoon commander. "We have some enemy activity in your vicinity. Possible snipers. Want to engage with a Bradley main gun. I need you to confirm your position, 100%. "Roger," he replied. "I have already triple checked. Building direct to our south is 9-1. South of that is the road. The roof of our building has an L-shaped room on the roof. You can see it on the battle map. I'm sitting in it. It is confirmed. We are in Building 9-4. 100%. Over." I acknowledged the Delta Platoon commander's transmission. Then, to the company commander next to me, I said, "It's confirmed. My guys are in Building 9-4. "All right then, let's hammer these guys," the company commander replied. "Hold on," I said, checking one more time. "Let's confirm what your guys are seeing." "We have confirmed. Enemy snipers on the rooftop of Building 7-9, responded the company commander. "There are no other friendlies in that building. We need to engage while we can." He didn't want to miss a critical chance to take out enemy snipers. I didn't like the idea of delaying an opportunity to eliminate enemy snipers any more than he did. But knowing the confusing chaos of the urban battlefield and how easily mistakes can happen, I had to be certain. "Do me a favor," I asked the company commander, "just to confirm. Have your Bradley vehicle commander count the number of buildings he sees from the major intersection, where he was positioned, up to the building where he has eyes on the enemy snipers." The company commander looked at me with a little frustration. If these were indeed enemy snipers, they might target U.S. forces at any moment. Allowing them to live even for a few more minutes meant they might very well kill Americans. "I just want to be sure," I added. The company commander didn't work for me. I couldn't order him to delay. But through multiple combat operations together with our SEALs in this difficult environment, we had developed a strong professional working relationship. He loved our SEALs and appreciated the damage we inflicted on the enemy. He now trusted me enough to comply with my request. "Okay," he said. The company commander keyed up his radio and instructed his Bradley vehicle commander. "For final confirmation, count the number of buildings from the intersection where you're located to the building where you see the enemy snipers." The Bradley vehicle commander paused at this, likely wondering why he was being asked to do this while enemy snipers waited to attack. But he did as directed, replying on the radio, "Roger that, stand by." It should have taken no more than 15 seconds to count the buildings up the block to the target building, but the silence over the radio was longer. Too long. Finally, the radio silence broke. "Correction. The suspected enemy position is building 9-4. I say again, 9-4. I counted the buildings up the block. We misjudged the distance. Over." "Hold your fire," the company commander quickly said with authority over his battalion net, recognizing that the enemy reported in building 9-4 were really friendlies. "All stations, hold your fire. Personnel in building 9-4 are friendly. I say again, building 9-4 is a friendly position. We have SEAL snipers on the roof of that building." "Roger," said the Bradley vehicle commander in a solemn tone, recognizing his mistake had almost caused fratricide. "Roger," answered the captain, alarmed at how easily such a mistake could happen and acknowledging how deadly and devastating it could have been. The company commander looked at me and said heavily, "That was a close one." Without formal street signs or numbers, with confusing intersections and alleyways, such a mix-up was something that could easily happen. But had they engaged, it would have been horrific. The 25mm heavy gun from the Bradley fired high explosive rounds that would have ripped through the rooftop, likely killing or wounding multiple SEALs in that position. Thankfully, our troop operated under decentralized command. My platoon commanders didn't just tell me what the situation was, but what they were going to do to fix it. That sort of extreme ownership and leadership from my subordinate leaders not only allowed them to lead confidently, but also allowed me to focus on the bigger picture. In this case, monitoring the actions of coordinating units in this dynamic environment. Had I been engulfed in trying to lead and direct Charlie and Delta Platoon's tactical decisions from my distant position, I may very well have missed the other events unfolding. This could have had catastrophic results. Instead, decentralized command worked and enabled us as a team to effectively manage risk, prevent disaster, and accomplish our mission. Soon, the real enemy fighters struck with violent attacks to protect their territory along the central north-south street. But our enemy's enthusiasm was extinguished quickly when SEAL snipers and machine gunners killed them in the very streets they aimed to defend. Decentralized command enabled us to operate effectively on a challenging battlefield and support our U.S. Army comrades to construct the new combat outpost and ensure more soldiers came home safely. Ultimately, this furthered the strategic mission to stabilize Ramadi and secure the populace, which would prove highly successful over the coming months. Principal. Human beings are generally not capable of managing more than 6 to 10 people, particularly when things go sideways and inevitable contingencies arise. No one senior leader can be expected to manage dozens of individuals, much less hundreds. Teams must be broken down into manageable elements of 4 to 5 operators with a clearly designated leader. These leaders must understand the overall mission and the ultimate goal of that mission, the commander's intent. Junior leaders must be empowered to make decisions on key tasks necessary to accomplish that mission in the most effective and efficient manner possible. Teams within teams are organized for maximum effectiveness for a particular mission, with leaders who have clearly delineated responsibilities. Every tactical level team leader must understand not just what to do, but why they are doing it. If frontline leaders do not understand why, they must ask their boss to clarify why. This ties in closely with Believe, Chapter 3. Decentralized command does not mean junior leaders or team members operate on their own program. That results in chaos. Instead, junior leaders must fully understand what is within their decision-making authority, the left and right limits of their responsibility. Additionally, they must communicate with senior leaders to recommend decisions outside their authority and pass critical information up the chain so the senior leadership can make informed, strategic decisions. SEAL leaders on the battlefield are expected to figure out what needs to be done and do it, to tell higher authority what they plan to do, rather than ask, "What do you want me to do?" Junior leaders must be proactive, rather than reactive. To be effectively empowered to make decisions, it is imperative that frontline leaders execute with confidence. Tactical leaders must be confident that they clearly understand the strategic mission and commander's intent. They must have implicit trust that their senior leaders will back their decisions. Without this trust, junior leaders cannot confidently execute, which means they cannot exercise effective decentralized command. To ensure this is the case, senior leaders must constantly communicate and push information, what we call in the military situational awareness, to their subordinate leaders. Likewise, junior leaders must push situational awareness up the chain to their senior leaders to keep them informed, particularly of crucial information that affects strategic decision-making. With SEAL teams, just as with any team in the business world, there are leaders who try to take on too much themselves. When this occurs, operations can quickly dissolve into chaos. The fix is to empower frontline leaders through decentralized command and ensure they are running their teams to support the overall mission without micromanagement from the top. There are, likewise, other senior leaders who are so far removed from the troops executing on the front line that they become ineffective. These leaders might give the appearance of control, but they actually have no idea what their troops are doing and cannot effectively direct their teams. We call this trait battlefield aloofness. This attitude creates a significant disconnect between leadership and the troops, and such a leader's team will struggle to effectively accomplish their mission. Determining how much leaders should be involved and where leaders can best position themselves to command and control the team is key. When SEAL task units train in assaults, in what we call close quarters battle, or CQB, we practice this in a kill house. A kill house is a multi-room facility with ballistic walls, which SEALs, other military, and police units use to rehearse their CQB skills. For young SEAL officers learning the ropes of leadership, running through the kill house with a platoon provides a great training opportunity to determine how much they should be involved and where to position themselves. Sometimes the officer gets so far forward that he gets sucked into every room clearance, meaning he is continually entering rooms and engaging targets. When that happens, he gets focused on the minutia of what's going on in the immediate room and loses situational awareness of what is happening with the rest of the team and can no longer provide effective command and control. Other times, the officer gets stuck in the back of the train on cleanup duty. When that happens, he is too far in the rear to know what is happening up front and can't direct his assault force. I advised many officers that the right amount of involvement, the proper position for them, was somewhere in the middle, generally with the bulk of their force. Not so far forward that they get sucked into every room clearance, but not so far back that they don't know what is going on up front. Contrary to a common misconception, leaders are not stuck in any particular position. Leaders must be free to move where they are most needed, which changes throughout the course of an operation. Understanding proper positioning as a leader is a key component of decentralized command, not just on the battlefield. In any team, business, or organization, the same rule applies. The effectiveness of decentralized command is critical to the success of any team in any industry. In chaotic, dynamic, and rapidly changing environments, leaders at all levels must be empowered to make decisions. Decentralized command is a key component to victory. Application to business. Can I take a look at your org chart? I asked the regional president of an investment advisor group. The org chart depicted his team's organizational structure and chain of command. Responsible for dozens of branches and over 1,000 employees, the president was smart and driven. He didn't have a great deal of leadership confidence, though he seemed eager to learn. "We don't really have one that is current," the president responded. "I like to hold that information close. If it gets out and people see it, they might get upset that they actually report to someone they see as one of their peers. I've had to deal with this before." "So how do they know who's in charge?" I asked. "Without a clear chain of command, without people knowing who is in charge of what, you cannot have empowered leadership. And that is critical to the success of any team, including the SEAL teams or your company here." "Let me pull up what we have," said the president. He opened a document on his computer and swung an organizational chart onto the large plasma screen on the wall of the conference room. I stood up and took a look. The team for which he was responsible was a region of substantial size and breadth. There were branches spread across a huge geographic area of the United States. But there was something that stood out to me. The org chart lacked uniformity and seemed disorganized. "What's this here?" I asked, as I pointed to a location that listed 22 people who worked there. "That's a branch," the president answered. "Who leads all those people?" I asked. "The branch manager," he responded. "He leads all 21 of those people? They all report to him?" I inquired. "Yes, he's in charge of all of them," said the president. I looked at another area on the org chart. I tapped another office location, this one with 3 people in it. "And what's this here?" I asked. "That is also a branch," the president replied. "Who leads these people?" I asked. "The branch manager," he said. "He leads 2 people?" I asked. "That's right," said the president. "So one branch manager leads 21 people, and the other branch manager leads 2 people?" I clarified. "Yeah, a little strange, but it makes sense on the ground," the president offered. "How?" I asked. If it wasn't clear to me looking at the org chart, I knew it was highly likely that it didn't make sense to the frontline troops that were out there executing the company's mission. "Well, the bigger branches have more people because they are more successful, and they generally have a stronger manager. Because he or she is effective, the branch grows and requires more employees, which increases the number of direct reports. Over time, some branches can get pretty big," the president explained. "What happens to the efficiency of the branch when they grow?" "You know, honestly, once a branch reaches a certain size, rapid growth slows," he admitted. "The branch manager usually just focuses on the best performers, and the rest kind of get lost in the shuffle of day-to-day business. Over time, most of these branch managers seem to lose track of the bigger picture of what we are trying to do and where we are trying to strategically grow." "And what about the smaller branches?" I asked. "Why do they not grow?" "Surprisingly, it's for a similar reason," he replied. "When a branch has only a couple people in it, there isn't enough revenue for the branch manager to really make money. So those managers are forced to personally generate business themselves. When they are in the field selling, they generally don't have time to focus on leadership and management of their teams, and they lose track of the bigger picture, building and growing." "So what would you say the ideal size would be for a team or branch in your company?" I asked. "Probably 5 or 6, 4 or 5 financial advisors and support people," answered the president. "That makes perfect sense," I said. "The SEAL teams and the U.S. military, much like militaries throughout history, are based around building blocks of 4 to 6 man teams with a leader. We call them fire teams. That is the ideal number for a leader to lead. Beyond that, any leader can lose control as soon as even minimal pressure is applied to the team when inevitable challenges arise. So how do you lead larger teams on the battlefield? Asked the president with genuine curiosity. Sometimes for our units, we can operate with as many as 150 personnel on a particular operation, I answered. While we might only have 15 or 20 SEALs, when you tack on Iraqi soldiers and mutually supporting troops from the U.S. Army or Marine Corps, our ranks could easily grow to over 100 or 150, I explained. But the truth is, even with all those men out there, I could only truly lead, manage, and coordinate with about 4 to 6, max. I could see this had sparked some interest with the president. That is why we had to utilize decentralized command, I explained. I couldn't talk to every shooter in every platoon, squad, and fire team. I would talk to the platoon commander. He would take my guidance and pass it down to his squad leaders. His squad leaders would pass it on to their fire team leaders. And they would execute. If there was an army company supporting us, I would talk to the company commander, or perhaps one of the platoon commanders. And again, they would pass my guidance down to their subordinate leadership. Couldn't things get confused? Like in the old game of telephone, where you whisper a word around a circle of people and it comes back different from how it started? Asked the president. That is why simplicity is so important, I answered. Proper decentralized command requires simple, clear, concise orders that can be understood easily by everyone in the chain of command. I spelled out my commander's intent directly to the troops so they would know exactly what the ultimate goal of the mission was. That way, they would have the ability to execute on the battlefield in a manner that supported the overarching goal without having to ask for permission. Junior leaders must be empowered to make decisions and take initiative to accomplish the mission. That was critical to our success on the battlefield, and it will greatly help you here. But can't you end up with a bunch of little individual elements just doing whatever they want, helter-skelter? Asked the president with skepticism. You could end up with that if you, as a leader, failed to give clear guidance and set distinct boundaries, I explained. With clear guidance and established boundaries for decision-making that your subordinate leaders understand, they can then act independently toward your unified goal. I get it, said the president, a mission statement. That's part of it, I replied. But there is more. A mission statement tells your troops what you are doing, but they've got to understand why they are doing it. When the subordinate leadership and the frontline troops fully understand the purpose of the mission, how it ties into strategic goals, and what impact it has, they can then lead, even in the absence of explicit orders. That makes sense, he acknowledged. The teams have to be small enough that one person can truly lead them, I continued. Span of control is the commonly used business term. How many people can a leader effectively lead? In combat, depending on the experience and quality of the leader, the skill level and experience of the troops, and the level of violence and potential mayhem in an area, those numbers vary. You need to find out the optimal size for your teams. And if it is 5 or 6 with a leader at the top, then that is the way you should set them up. From a leadership perspective, I explained to the president, there is truly nothing more important than an understanding of the dynamics of decentralized command. This is proper command and control in a nutshell. It is one of the most complex strategies to pull off correctly. As a leader, it takes strength to let go. It takes faith and trust in subordinate frontline leaders and their abilities. Most of all, it requires trust up and down the chain of command. Trust that subordinates will do the right thing. Trust that superiors will support subordinates if they are acting in accordance with the mission statement and commander's intent. Trust is not blindly given. It must be built over time. Situations will sometimes require that the boss walk away from a problem and let junior leaders solve it, even if the boss knows he might solve it more efficiently. It is important that the junior leaders are allowed to make decisions and backed up even if they don't make them correctly. Open conversations build trust. Overcoming stress and challenging environments builds trust. Working through emergencies and seeing how people react builds trust. junior leaders must know that the boss will back them up, even if they make a decision that may not result in the best outcome, as long as the decision was made in an effort to achieve the strategic objective, I explained. That complete faith in what others will do, how they will react, and what decisions they will make is the key ingredient in the success of decentralized command. And this is integral to the success of any high-performance winning team. Understood, the president replied. I will make it happen.